Hi folks, can you hear me?
Yep.
Good. Okay, it's 12:30. As people keep joining in, I'm going to get started. Before I start, any questions? I know quite a few of you have sent your DCFs, and you won't get them back till probably Friday, Saturday, because I have cases to grade today and tomorrow for my corporate finance class. So I'm going to do that first. And then starting Friday, I'll start to go sequentially, depending on when you sent your DCF. You know, so you should start to see them this weekend. And so I'll get started as soon as I can. Are there any questions before we get started? No questions? Okay, so let's pick up where we left off. We were talking about valuing emerging market companies and the challenges you face with emerging market companies. And we ended with that Aramco valuation, where we looked at location risk, the risk of a regime change. Kind of showing how flexible a DCF is, even for those kinds of eventualities. Today, I want to start by talking about a different type of companies. I want to talk about financial service companies. I'll start by making a confession, and then I'll fill it in. I used to think that valuing banks was easy, and I'll explain why I made that assumption and why I think in hindsight I was wrong. Because when you value a bank or you're an insurance company or an investment bank, and you ask the questions, you know, the four questions: what are your cash flows from existing assets? What's value added by growth? How risky are your cash flows? When will you become a mature firm? Here are some of the problems you're going to run into. First, if you're looking at a bank, let's focus on banks because they're the most common financial service firm. Though everything I say about banks could apply to any other financial service firm. And ask you, what are your cash flows? Think of how we compute cash flows. We start with earnings, we add back depreciation, we subtract out CapEx, and we subtract out change in working capital, right? Try doing that for a bank. What is CapEx for a bank? What is change in working capital for a bank? In fact, in most banks, when you start to try to estimate cash flows, you give up very quickly. So the first problem is you can't even tell me what cash flows are. You can tell me what earnings are, but you pretty much get stuck after that. Second, when you think about the value of future growth, if you can't define what CapEx is, how do you decide whether you're earning a high enough return on capital? So things like measuring returns becomes really difficult to do. So value of growth becomes difficult to answer. Third, when asked how risky are your cash flows, again, when you think about financial service firms, debt is not a source of capital, it's raw material for you. So talking about a cost to capital kind of becomes meaningless for a financial service firm. And finally, when will you become a mature firm for a bank can often be driven by regulatory restrictions. Because to stay a bank, you often have to meet regulatory conditions, one of which is maintaining capital. So what are your cash flows? When will you become a mature firm? What is your risk and what's the value of growth? All become really difficult to answer. So you know what we do? With banks, and this is something people still continue to do, but until 2008, I'll make a confession, I used to do the same thing. We give up. And here's what we mean. What I mean by give up. The conventional approach with which most people value banks is with the dividend discount model. Think of why it's giving up. Instead of estimating cash flows, what are you doing? You're taking the dividend that the bank is paying and say, that's what my cash flow to equity has to be. The first thing to remember is with banks, you can value only equity. There's no such thing as valuing the firm and subtracting our debt because it doesn't make any sense. It's got to be equity focused. But since you cannot estimate free cash or equity, you kind of give up and you say, I'm going to take dividends instead. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to value a bank, and it's a pretty unconventional bank. It's a bank that many of you might not have heard of. It's called CIB. It's an Egyptian bank. It's the valuation I did in December of 2015. It's a pure dividend discount model. The dividend discount model you have two issues to deal with. One is, you know, the dividends last year, you know, but estimating future growth, here's what I did. I looked at the retention ratio, the percentage of income that the company is putting back into the business. It's about 75% for this bank. And the return on equity they had, which is sky high, 42%. Incidentally, I'm doing this valuation in Egyptian pounds, so some that's got to factor into why the return on equity is so high, because the inflation rate in Egyptian pounds is much higher. But even with that inflation, I'm getting a growth rate of 32% in net income. So here's what I do. I start by taking my earnings per share and projecting growth of 32% a year for the next 5 years, and then scaling that growth rate down to a stable growth rate of 10%. You say a stable growth rate of 10%, that's impossible. In US dollars, you're absolutely right. But in Egyptian pounds, where the risk-free rate is 10.5%, I can use a 10% growth rate forever. So over this period, here's what I do. I estimate earnings. I keep the payout ratio at the 24.75%, the existing payout ratio for the next 5 years. And as my growth starts to decrease, my payout ratio climbs. In fact, what I do is I estimate the payout ratio in stable growth by assuming that in stable growth, to grow 10% a year, I will have to reinvest about 40% of my income. And it actually comes from estimating a return on equity forever of 25%. Again, it looks outlandishly high, but in Egyptian pounds for a bank, not that high. So 10% divided by 25% gives me a retention ratio of 40%, which means I have to pay out 60%. So let's fill in the details. As my earnings per share grow, you see my 5.33 earnings per share become 37.97. As my growth decreases, my 25% payout ratio becomes 60%. I get expected dividends every year for the next 10 years. Beyond the 10th year, this should say earnings per share in year 10. Beyond the 10th year, or earnings per share in year 11, I take my earnings per share in year 11, apply the 60% payout ratio in perpetuity, and come up with the terminal value, present value of dividends in perpetuity, of 189. Now, to discount all these cash flows, I need a cost of equity in Egyptian pounds. I get the cost of equity by starting with the risk-free rate of 10.53% in pounds. I actually did this when we talked about risk-free rate, but it's so long ago, I don't blame you if you've forgotten. I started with the US dollar risk-free rate, the T-bond rate. I adjusted for the higher inflation in Egypt, 9.7% as opposed to the 1.5% in the US. I came up with a risk-free rate in pounds. So I'm starting with 10.53% as a base. I gave CIB the beta for banks. Notice what I'm not doing. Usually when I get betas, bottom-up betas, I start with the unlevered beta for the business you're in and lever up. I don't even want to get started on that because, as I said, defining debt for a bank is impossible. So I just use the beta for banks. I use an equity risk-free for Egypt because CIB gets all of its business in Egypt. My cost of equity is 23.25%. Remember that 25% looked high, the return equity in perpetuity? Well, relative to the 23.25%, it doesn't look that bad. So if I discount my dividends for the next 10 years and my terminal value back at 23%, I get a value per share of about £42 per share. The stock was trading at just over £36. I actually tried to buy shares in the company. It was almost impossible for me to get through to a broker who could buy me shares in the company. But here, if you look at my valuation, all I focused on are dividends. And the reason I'm doing it is because I can't estimate free cash flow equity. I've given up desperation. And I discount those dividends back at a cost of equity. My growth is driven by my retention ratio times my return equity. It's a very simple valuation built around the premise that dividends are the only cash flows you get from a bank. Any questions on this particular valuation? No? Okay. So let's now talk about what it is that makes banks difficult to value. I told you at the start of this today that I used to think valuing banks was easy. And let me tell you what that statement was based on. It was based on trust. I assumed that banks were run by sensible people. And I did assume, until 2008 at least, I used to think that the regulatory restrictions on banks would prevent them from doing stupid things. So if you assume that banks are run by sensible people and the regulatory overlay works, here's why you can use dividend discount models. First, if banks are sensible, they will pay out what they can afford to in dividends. In other words, you're assuming that over time, what banks pay out in dividends is roughly equal to free cash or equity. That's okay if banks are run by sensible people. And second, if they're regulated by an authority that actually keeps an eye on what banks are doing, you shouldn't have a high-risk bank or a low-risk bank, because a high-risk bank should be shut down by regulatory authorities. So we use the dividend discount model, and we use the average beta across banks, and we walk away saying, hey, I trust banks to do the right thing. That was until 2008. In fact, if you look at this valuation I did right in the middle of the crisis, that's when I realized I had to revisit how I value banks. It was about 4 weeks into the 2008 crisis, I was valuing Wells Fargo, and I was sticking with the only way I knew how to value back, which is with the dividend discount model. So I took their earnings and their dividends, and the only thing that had happened in the four-week crisis is, first, the risk premium I'd updated to make it higher to reflect the crisis. But the regulatory authorities clearly were scared. They were going to raise regulatory capital requirements. So the only adjustment I made for the crisis was I stayed with the dividend discount model, but I reduced my return on equity going forward for the fact that regulatory authorities would demand more capital at banks. So I'm still sticking with the dividend discount model, because in October of 2008, I did not know how to do anything else. And I reduced my expected growth rate because there was a crisis, and I increased my risk premium for the same reason. Same bank, I valued 4 weeks earlier and got a much higher value, but now with the lower growth and the higher cost of equity, the value per share that I got was 30.29. The stock was trading at about 33. The reason I did this is people were telling me banks were an incredible bargain because they'd been knocked down so much in price. And Wells Fargo had seen its stock price drop from $53 down to $33. And everybody said, you should buy Wells Fargo. So when I revalued the bank and I looked at the numbers, I said, it's been knocked down a lot, but I still don't see why it's a bargain. It's still overvalued. So when you can stay with the dividend discount model, if you're valuing banks today, but be careful, because this crisis, like the 2008 crisis, is going to create issues at banks. You need to figure out how to adjust your dividends for it. So banks are opaque, and generally we've gotten away with using the dividend discount model because of the trust we have that banks are run by sensible people and the regulatory overlay works. But here's what 2008 taught me. 2008 taught me that I couldn't trust banks. I couldn't trust the regulatory authorities. Why? Because look at what banks did in 2008. They took risks and the regulatory authorities let them get away with it. And I discovered in hindsight that banks are not run by sensible people. In fact, I'm convinced that banks are run by some of the least sensible people in the world. And what do I mean? Well, in 2009 and 2010, banks continued to pay dividends, even though they were losing tons of money. It made absolutely no sense, but they did it anyway. So I had to revisit my assumptions about how to value banks. In fact, many banks suspended dividends, and with the dividend discount model, all you can discount is dividends, and dividends have gone away. What value do you attach to a bank? So I decided to change my focus. I said, look, for a bank, book equity actually means something, because book equity becomes the basis for regulatory capital. For a traditional company, I really don't care about book value of equity turning negative. It means nothing. But for a bank, when book equity drops too low, the bank is in trouble. So I reframed the entire process to think about what reinvestment for a bank should be. I said, for a bank to grow and survive, it doesn't have to build plant and equipment or invest in working capital. It's got to invest in regulatory capital. So I said, my free cash or equity for a bank is therefore my net income minus whatever I have to reinvest in regulatory capital to keep going. Think about it. If you're a high growth bank, your reinvestment in regulatory capital then have to be higher to sustain that growth. If you're a troubled bank with low regulatory capital ratios, your reinvestment has to be higher to get back to steady state. Once I do this, I no longer have to trust dividends. I can estimate the free cash flow equity for a bank. So what I've done is reframe my definition of reinvestment to make it regulatory capital, and it's going to allow me to value a bank using a free cash flow equity model. So let me try this on a bank that you've all heard of, but a bank that's gotten into serious trouble in the last few years. So in October of 2016, I valued Deutsche Bank. In fact, it's a blog post. You can go to my blog and check it out. And the title of the post was A Greek Tragedy at a German Bank. And the reason I chose those words is the Germans keep trying to point out how undisciplined the Greeks are. And here you have the ultimate German bank, Deutsche Bank, you know, bank that's been around a century. It stands in for Germany, going through troubles that you'd expect a Greek bank to go through. And here's what the troubles were. Deutsche was ambitious, you know, leading in the 80s, the 90s. They wanted to be the, you know, big investment bank. So they grew in the US, they expanded into investment banking. And in, until 2008, they were kind of rising with the tide. And then 2008 hits and Deutsche got into serious trouble. In fact, while most other banks came back from the 2008 crisis, Deutsche never came back. It continued to lose money. It continued to have trouble. And every time you lose money as a bank, remember what happens, your book equity decreases. And so Deutsche kept getting into deeper and deeper into trouble each year that it lost money. Then in 2016 came a blow that really threatened to tip Deutsche over. The Department of Justice in the United States assessed an $8 billion fine on Deutsche for something it did in 2008. Now remember, when you have a fine, that fine comes out of your equity. So that threatened to push Deutsche's equity to dangerously low levels. In fact, the level was going to get so dangerously low that there was talk that the German government might have to actually take over Deutsche, put it into receivership. You can't really liquidate a bank. It's not feasible. Now, because how do you liquidate a bank? People have deposits in banks. What happens is it gets taken over by the government and brought back again. So there's talk about Deutsche being taken into that, taken over by the German government. So I decided to value Deutsche Bank. And here's what it looked like. In 2015, the trailing 12 months, it had a loss of minus 8.9 billion. Its tier one capital ratio, those of you not familiar with tier one capital, it's a regulatory measure of capital, very closely tied to book equity, was 12.41%, well below what they needed it to be healthy. So here's what I have, a trouble bank. It's losing money, it's not paying dividends, and it's got a low regulatory capital ratio. I decided to fix it. You know what I need to do to fix it, right? Over time, I first had to make a judgment on what their tier one capital ratio would have to get to for them to feel comfortable. And over time, I pushed the tier one capital ratio to the 75th percentile of all banks. Why 75th? Because Deutsche has an investment banking arm. And if you have an investment banking arm, you tend to be riskier. If you're riskier, your capital ratio should be higher. So I said, over time, the tier one capital ratio has to go up. Already, you can see what's coming, right? As the tier one capital ratio goes up, and you have to invest more tier one capital, Deutsche has to invest more in regulatory capital. So based on my judgment, they will have to invest about 6.6 billion euros in tier one capital in year one. And then you can see they have to keep investing in tier one capital just to keep going. I also assume, this is my optimistic part of my story, that over time their return in equity would stop being negative, turn positive, and converge on Deutsche's cost of equity. This is not a happy story. Even in steady state, all Deutsche Bank will do is earn its cost of equity. And that cost of equity, I've assumed, will be at the higher end. So basically the 9.44%, their end cost of equity, is where I put their return equity. So as their return equity goes from -13.7 to 9.44%, my net losses become net profits. Do you see the pieces I'm building here? Each year that my return equity improves, my losses become profits. But from that, I subtract out my investment in regulatory capital because I need to have more in regulatory capital. Here's what my free cash flow equity looks like for Deutsche in year one. They have to invest about they have to come up with 11.66 billion in new equity in year one just to keep going. Another 3.7 billion, another 1.58 billion. And here's the other optimistic part of my story. I'm assuming they're going to be able to raise that equity. Why? Because the rest of the world was pretty healthy when this was happening, and Deutsche should be able to access the equity. So I have my free cash flows equity. Those are the free cash flows I'm going to discount. Incidentally, I'm no longer assuming the cost of equity for every bank is the same. I'm assuming that Deutsche is one of the riskier banks and I give it a higher cost of equity. The cost of equity is the 75th percentile. So I'm set. I have costs of equities and I have free cash flows equity. I discount them back. I get a value of equity today. If I divide by the number of shares, I get a value per share today. But Deutsche is in serious trouble, right? There's a talk that the German government might take them over. One more shock to the system, that could happen to them. I attach only a low probability to that. Why? Because they're too big to take over. The German government doesn't want to do it. I think people that Deutsche owes money to will bend over backwards to keep it going. So I attach a 10% chance of failure. And if that happens, I assume my equity would get wiped out. My expected value would be 90% times 22.97 plus 10% times zero. I get a value per share of 2067. Stock was trading at 1333. I did buy Deutsche. Luckily, I got out in time because a year and a half later, Deutsche made a rights issue. You know what a rights issue is? Basically, they gave people who own shares the right to buy additional shares, and they raised about 11 billion. Why? They did exactly what I predicted. They raised the capital to make the regulatory capital ratio safer. I sold my shares when that rights offering was made because the stock had gone up to like $26, $27 per share. I got incredibly lucky because now Deutsche is down to single digits and it's in trouble again. This watching Deutsche is like watching a Halloween movie where people, you know, Freddy Krueger, he never dies, he keeps coming back. Deutsche finds new ways to find new disasters. This is a disaster company in the making. But what I want you to focus on is how I've estimated free cash flow equity for a bank. And essentially it requires a rethinking of what free cash flow equity is. Don't try net capex and change in working capital. It's not going to work for a bank. You have to think about free reinvestment differently to be even to be able to even estimate free cash flow equity. Any questions?
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
How do changes in the curve affect, because as far as I know, if the rates go down, banks suffer. And how do you see that in your DCF? Through changes in return on equity?
Yeah, it's going to show up in the return on equity, right? Because if you think about a conventional bank and how it makes money on the spread. You know what I mean by the spread? It's a difference between what they pay out to their customers and what they collect from the people they make loans to. When rates get negative, especially, banks are in trouble. Why? Because their deposit rates can't go below zero. So they're paying 0% to their customers. You think that's good? But the people that they're lending money to, they can't, you know, they're charging only 0.1% or 0.2%. In fact, there are some corporate borrowers in Europe who will be able to borrow at a negative rate. As a bank, you're getting squeezed because rates have become low. It'll show up as a low return on equity.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions on valuing financial service companies? So if you're working with a bank, an insurance company, investment bank, first, stay equity focused. My suggestion is if you're uncomfortable with regulatory capital and regulatory capital ratios, stick with the dividend discount model. It's old fashioned. Just make sure you're internally consistent. Stick with the dividend discount model. If you're comfortable with regulatory capital requirements, do what I did with Deutsche. See whether you can value a bank using free cash flow equity. It's more realistic. No other questions? Let's move on to companies with intangible assets. Accounting is making a big deal of this. Tangible, intangible. They act like they invented the word intangible. But it is true. When you have a company which has intangible assets, it's patents, it's a drug, it's a technology, you have a tough time with accounting. And here's why. When I ask you, what are your cash flows of existing assets? Since those assets are not even put on the balance sheet, you have a tough time even answering the question. When I ask you for the value of growth, given that you're not capitalizing those assets, if you don't capitalize R&D, and you don't capitalize what you're investing to get those intangible assets, you're going to have sky-high returns on capital, even though your projects might not be that good. And when you think about risk, the way this shows up is it's difficult, more difficult to borrow money against intangible assets than tangible. Why? For whatever reason, banks and borrowers like to lend against physical assets, so your debt ratios will tend to be low. And finally, if you think about yourself becoming a mature company and if you decide to liquidate at any time, it's very difficult to convert intangible assets back into cash. So with intangible assets, the biggest problem you face is an accounting problem. The accountants have not been consistent in how they account for intangible assets. Remember all the time I spent on capitalizing R&D and you wondered, why are you wasting your time? The reason is very simple. If I don't do the right thing, if I don't capitalize what companies are spending to build their intangible assets, R&D for technology companies, human capital investments for companies that get most of their value from their workers, I will not be able to value the companies. So what I'm going to essentially do is I'm going to capitalize R&D, I'm going to bring it onto the balance sheet, and then I'm on much firmer ground in asking the question, what are your cash flows? What's the value of growth? That's why we capitalize R&D, because without that, you're kind of stuck in the dark with technology companies. And it's not just R&D. It could be advertising expenses for a consumer product company. It could be what you spend on recruiting and training for a consulting firm. I'm trying to bring those back and treat them as CapEx, because if I do that, then I have a much better shot at valuing the companies. So I'm going to take you back a long time. I know you've forgotten this, but I converted R&D for, I think, Cisco. I did the same thing for Amgen. I gave it a 10-year life. Why? Because for pharmaceutical companies, it takes a long time between the time you do R&D and a commercial product emerges. And I went through the process of capitalizing R&D. Remember how I did that? If I have a 10-year life, I collect the R&D for the last 10 years. So that's what the R&D year is. Then I start writing off 1/10 every year. And I keep track of two numbers. How much I'm writing off this year, which in the case of Amgen is $1,694 million. And what's left that's not been written off? $13,284 million. Now let's trace out how that's going to affect my numbers. What I've done in this table is computed what the numbers for Amgen would look like if I trusted the accountants. That's in the second column. And if I adjust for R&D. Okay? So net income, if I trust the accountants, Amgen made $4.2 billion. If I capitalize R&D, it looks like they made a lot more money. Amgen is more profitable than I think they are once you capitalize R&D. So they make more net income. For the book equity, if I trusted the accountants and I just looked at what's on the balance sheet, they have $17.9 billion book equity. When I capitalize R&D, I add the $13,284, my book equity increases. My return on equity, if I look at the accounting numbers, gives me a 23.5% return equity. But if I capitalize R&D, remember I have higher net income, and higher book equity, I get a high R&D. It's not something I want to sneeze at, but it's still lower than what it was before I made the adjustment. When I look at operating income, their operating income before I capitalized R&D was $5.6 billion. Once I capitalize R&D, it increases to $6.93 billion. So the adjustment I'm making to income is I'm adding back this year's expense. That's what the 30-30 is. And I'm subtracting out the amortization. And I do that for both net income and operating income. My book value of invested capital is $35,269, much higher because I've capitalized R&D. So here's what happens. I have higher earnings for Amgen, higher invested capital, but lower returns. In the case of Amgen, that adjusted return on capital is still higher than the cost of capital. But there'll be some firms when you capitalize R&D, the R&D will, the return on capital will actually drop below the cost of capital. That's your danger zone. Those are companies that you thought were good companies before you capitalized R&D. But now that you've capitalized it, you get a very different perspective. You say, who cares? How much of an effect can this have? I actually valued Amgen with R&D capitalized. And what I mean by R&D capitalized is all the numbers you see on this page reflect the capitalized R&D numbers. The operating income you see here, $7,336, is not the number you'd have seen in the income statement. It's a number that you get when you capitalize R&D. The reinvestment net capex includes the R&D investment. So every number here is with R&D capitalized. And with R&D capitalized, the value per share that I get is $74. Because here's what I get. I get a company that's reinvesting a lot because R&D is part of capex and I'm counting acquisitions. And even if I normalize that reinvestment rate, looking across time, I end up with a high growth rate. So the high R&D here is helping Amgen, pushing up their growth rate and increasing value per share. You see, this is good. Let me capitalize R&D for every company and increase the value per share. Well, let's look at what's happening here. Basically, I've given you the numbers for operating income, invested capital, return on capital before the R&D adjustment and after. In fact, if you use any of my spreadsheets, just turning that R&D tab, yes to no, will allow you to see the comparison. My value per share, if I hadn't made the R&D adjustment at Amgen, would have been only 43. With the capitalization, the value goes up to 74. But that's just for Amgen. I did exactly the same thing for Merck at the time that I did this valuation. And there, when I made the R&D adjustment, my value per share decreased when I capitalized R&D. So I'm going to ask you a question that cuts to the heart of why the R&D adjustment matters. Why, in the case of Amgen, when I adjust R&D, is my value going up? And why, when I do the same thing for Merck at that point in time, did my value go down? What does that tell you about R&D at these two companies? Anybody want to give it a shot? Okay, go ahead, Salma.
Does it maybe relate to the rate of depreciation with how much you're expensing each year on R&D?
That, and remember, why do you do R&D? Because you want your earnings to go up, right? So basically, R&D by itself is neither good nor bad. It's just an investment. What you do when you capitalize R&D is you're asking the question about R&D that you ask about any investment. Is it a positive net present value investment? Am I creating or destroying value with R&D? In the case of Amgen, what's the answer to that? Are they creating value or destroying value when they do R&D? Dave?
Yeah, they're increasing value because of the fact that the R&D may lead to future.
And what is it in the R&D that's allowing them to increase value? The drugs go through the pipeline quicker, they get approved quicker, and they actually produce revenues quicker. What's the definition of bad R&D? You spend a lot of money, nothing comes out of the pipeline, or if it comes out of the pipeline, the revenues are bad. The case of Merck, in the 10 years leading into this, the valuation ended of Merck, they'd spent $100 billion of R&D, and their earnings had stayed flat. You know why we capitalize R&D is to make a difference, or to draw a difference between companies that do good R&D, that actually create value, like Amgen, and separate them from companies that do bad R&D. For some reason, people seem to think R&D is good. Companies that do R&D are being innovative. It's easy to spend money on R&D. It's difficult to convert that into earnings, and Amgen is doing that well, but Merck wasn't. That's why we capitalize R&D. Any questions before we move on? Dave, you have a follow-up question, or your hand, just your hand up from before?
Okay.
Good. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say about intangibles. Now let's move on to cyclical and commodity companies. Cyclical companies are companies like housing, automobiles. Commodity companies, of course, oil companies, iron ore mining companies, basically any company that gets its, you know, revenues from a commodity. Let's think about why valuing these companies can be tricky. Let's ask those four questions again. What are your cash flows from existing assets? Let's make this an oil company, make our life simple. I'm going to ask you, what are your cash flows from existing assets? Even if you're a mature oil company, you know what's going to drive it? What's going to drive the revenues and earnings for an oil company more than anything else? Anybody? Go ahead, Chen.
I think steel.
For an oil company?
Oh, for oil company?
Yeah.
Oil price.
Oil price, right? So this year's going to be a terrible year for oil companies. We don't even have to look at the financials. Why? Because oil prices have gone from about $55 per barrel to $22 a barrel, or less than 20 today. So what are your cash flows from existing assets? The answer is going to depend on whether oil prices are high or low. Okay. Now I ask you, what's the value of future growth? When I asked that question 10 years ago, when oil prices were $100 a barrel, every oil company looked at its projects, and what did they say? Amazing projects. They're all great projects. The return on capital looks amazing. You take those same projects and you ask the question today, terrible projects. You're saying, what was I thinking? So whether your growth is high value, low value, or negative value also depends on the oil price. You're saying, how risky are you? Well, if you're an oil company and oil prices are 100, you feel flush, you feel safe, you have lots of cash flows, your debt looks safe, your default spreads are low, your cost of capital is low. Same oil company, 5 years later, oil prices are down to $20 a barrel, you look like a disaster zone. How risky are you? The answer again is affected by the oil price. And finally, when I ask you, when will you become a mature firm? When oil prices are 100, you feel really good. That'll be in 10 years. Today, if I ask an oil company, when will you be a mature firm? You know what their answer is? If oil prices stay $20 a barrel, I'll never make it. Every question, the answer you get is going to depend on something macro, the oil price. Dave, go ahead.
Well, I have a pushback on this because I think that many of the oil companies have been advertising their efforts to embrace renewable energy and embrace renewable energy projects. So technically, couldn't they say that their growth comes from those
things? Don't believe everything you hear. Oil prices stay at $20 a barrel. green energy is more of a side gain for these companies. Green energy is making, let's face it, nobody is making money on green energy. The only way green energy survives as a business is with subsidies. You know what's going to kill green energy? If oil prices stay $20 a barrel, God help you if you're a green energy company. Green energy is completely a side game now. Royal Dutch, Exxon Mobil, you take any of the big oil companies, or even the mid-size oil companies, if oil prices stay at $22 a barrel, they're dead in the water. Green energy can't bail them out.
Okay.
That's what makes this so dangerous, is if oil prices stay $22 a barrel, it's not just oil companies that are going to come down, it's windmill companies, it's green energy companies, because how the heck do you compete? I mean, already gas prices have dropped below $1.50, you know, in much of the country. If you are an electric car maker, I just made your life a lot more difficult. Green energy requires high oil prices. So it's all connected. Green energy is not going to bail them out.
Just one last question.
Yeah.
If you look at the unit economics from like a company like SolarEdge, which makes solar
panels.
Yeah, solar panels. The unit economics of it, they say, is lower, like per...
Only with the subsidies.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, without the subsidies, you're still very, very... And if you make... Remember, what the reason they're saying that is power prices are... But power prices in much of the country are driven by the price of oil and gas.
It's true.
And the unit economics at $22 a barrel gas oil prices is very different than the unit economics. So when they talk about unit economics being positive, it's based on oil price maybe of $60 or $70 a barrel, not $22.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions?
Professor, I have a question.
Yeah.
Just going back to the previous point, like how does capitalizing R&D distinguish bad company and good company in terms of R&D spending, because you depreciate by straight right line for both of them?
No, but you also increase your capital, right? So go back and look at the adjustment. What's the return on capital after the adjustment? You have a much bigger invested capital, right? And in the numerator, you're going to... What?
Oh, but like wouldn't... Since you have your time
span... It's not the depreciation. It's the remaining capital that's not been depreciated that drives your return on capital. So if you're spending a lot of money on R&D, your capital, invested capital, is going to be a much bigger number. But let's say you're a company like Merck that's been spending a lot of money on R&D and you have nothing to show for it in your earnings. Your earnings stay frozen. Your invested capital increases. What's going to happen to your return on invested capital? It's going to decrease. It's not the depreciation. It's the effect it has on earnings and invested capital. So if you take a company that is investing a lot in R&D and doesn't have increased earnings, its return on capital will decrease when you capitalize R&D by a lot.
I see.
That's the consequence.
Thank you.
Carolina?
Yeah, actually I have a follow-up question on the green energy. And yes, you're right that in the short run, actually the green energy is much more pricey than gas, etc. But in the long run, as you produce this energy and you compare the cost of the energy that you basically get for free versus the cost for the gas that you have to still pay, wouldn't the cost of green energy be lower?
You know what, the hopeful part of me, the part which is hopeful about climate change, says I hope so, but it's hope. Because how long is long term? I mean, a $22 oil price, it might take you 30 years to break even if you are a solar energy company or a, you know. So it's actually very difficult to get the economics of green energy working at a $22 oil price. I'm not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing. It's just, it is what it is. So if you're worried about climate change, you should be terrified about $22 oil prices. It's very difficult. Green energy to begin with has always had trouble making money. The only way green energy companies have survived is because they get subsidies. Subsidies either to their customers or subsidies as companies. You take a business that's subsidized and you make their competitors' costs much, much lower, which is what their oil companies are, you're going to make it much more difficult. So you might be right in the really, really long term, but in the really, really long term, we're all dead. There might be no companies around to take advantage of it.
Okay, gotcha.
Dave, you have a question?
Yeah, about the R&D, just making sure that in the sales to capital ratio, that also includes R&D.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly.
Okay, makes sense.
Everything has to have R&D capitalized. So one of the things when you see my industry averages for sales to capital, my industry averages for every industry include capitalized R&D. Okay. It will not match what you see in a service for any of these companies. And it's because I'm capitalizing R&D for every company.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So oil is lurking in the background with every one of these companies. You're saying, so what? When you value commodity or cyclical companies, it's very easy to get lost in macro assumptions. You know what I mean by that? When you sit down to value an oil company, what's front and center? You're saying, what will the oil price be a year from now? What will it be 5 years from now? And it's human nature to do that. When you're valuing a cyclical company, it's human nature to worry about, hey, will the economy get stronger or weaker? But the problem with being macro focused is you lose sight of your company. I've seen people value cyclical companies and spend 99% of their time worrying about the economy. And then at the last 1% of the time, say, oh, I have to think about my company. My advice to you when you're valuing companies that are driven by macro variables is to keep your macro views out of the valuation. You know what I mean by that? Let's suppose you're valuing an oil company and you believe oil prices will not stay 22. They're going to jump back to $60 in 3 years. I'll save you the trouble of valuing an oil company. If you build that prediction into your oil company valuation, every oil company on the face of the earth is going to look cheap to you. You're saying, so what? If you really are that confident in predicting oil prices, what the heck are you doing valuing an oil company? There's a much easier way for you to make money. What should you do? If you're very good at forecasting oil prices, how should you take advantage of it? What should you do? Buy oil futures, right? Or oil options. Why the heck would you try to buy Royal Dutch or ExxonMobil or Conoco if you're making a better? So if you're really good at forecasting macro variables, don't even waste your time valuing companies. But if you want to value companies, you got to focus on the company, which means when you value these companies, you want to think about how your company's value will change as a function of that macro variable, oil prices and oil companies. But then you've got to build it into evaluation. Remember a couple of sessions ago, I used a Monte Carlo simulation to value Amazon. And the reason I did that is I felt really uncertain about revenue growth and margins and sales to capital ratios. And I made them all assumptions. One of the companies I'm thinking about buying is Conoco. So let's say I want to value Conoco, big oil company. What's the only variable that I'm really uncertain about? The company's been around forever. It's a mature company. I know a great deal about the company. I'm feeling pretty confident about most of my numbers. What's the one number I'm not confident about? The oil price, right? It's $20 today. I have no idea what it'll be in the future. The one thing I know with certainty is it's going to be different in the future. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to value the company at the prevailing oil price, which right now is going to give you a terrible valuation for most of these companies. So I'll take you back in time. This was in March of 2016. I valued Royal Dutch, big oil company. And I did an oil price neutral valuation of Royal Dutch. Let me explain what I mean by this. At the time that I valued Royal Dutch, the oil price was $40 a barrel. I valued Royal Dutch on the assumption that oil price at $40, that was going to be the normal price. So what I did first was I estimated what their revenues would have to be. So I could not take the last 12 months of data. And here's why. In the trailing 12 months, oil prices had averaged $55 a barrel. Now the price was down to 40. Many of you are valuing oil companies who face exactly the same challenge. The trailing 12-month numbers you have for Conoco reflect a different oil price. If I take that trailing 12-month number and make that my base year, the bottom is going to fall. It's essentially going to blow up on my valuation. I'm going to overvalue. No, any oil company today, if I use the trailing 12-month numbers. So the first thing I did was I restated the trailing 12-month numbers. You're saying, how did you restate it? I'm going to show you in a minute how I came up with this equation. But basically, it's a way of me forecasting what the revenues for Royal Dutch would have been in the most recent 12 months, if oil prices had been $40 a barrel. I came up with revenues of about $201 billion. That was about $10, maybe $12 billion lower than their actual revenues. But the reason they're lower is because the oil price is down. I valued Royal Dutch using that starting revenue and assuming that oil prices would continue to be around $40 a barrel. The value per share that I got was $39.31. So if you look at the valuation, it's a very conventional valuation, but it's built around the presumption that that $40 is a regular price, that the earnings and revenues will reflect that price, $39 per share, right? So let's say I valued the company and I pointed it out and said, the value for Royal Dutch is 39, and let's say the stock price is 35. And he said, it looks undervalued, but then he said, what if oil prices change? And I'll give you the easy answer. The oil prices change, what's going to happen to that value? It's going to change as well. So here's what I did. I actually looked at the history of Royal Dutch. And Royal Dutch has a very long history, going back to 1989. I looked at the revenues every year. That's the blue bar. And I looked at the average oil price every year. Do the two look like they move together? They certainly do, right? In fact, I didn't trust my eyes, so I ran an R-squared, and the R-squared between oil prices and Royal Dutch revenues was about 96%. That's astonishing, right? Royal Dutch is almost an oil, pure play in oil. In fact, if I ran a regression of revenues against oil prices over this period, I get this equation, 39,993 plus every dollar increase in the barrel of oil increases my revenues by 4,039. If you go back to the previous page, that's exactly what I used to get my revenues last year, is I used the history of Royal Dutch to say, if oil prices had been $40 a barrel, their revenue should have been $201 billion. But I'm going to actually use this to make my valuation more dynamic. So with this equation, I can tell you what the revenues for oil Dutch would have to be for any given oil price, right? So if you tell me the oil price is going to jump to 60, I can revalue Royal Dutch at 60. If you tell me it's going to go to 80, I'll revalue it at 80. If it goes to 20, I can revalue it at 20. Caravan, you have a question or is your hand up from before? Dave, you have a question or your hand up from before? Your hand is up from before, just put it down because otherwise I'm not sure. So I now have a way of projecting out what rate. Chen, go ahead.
I was wondering for operating cost, you should keep it relatively constant, right?
Yeah, because operating costs, I essentially looked at the margins over there. It's a revenue number that collapses at these companies. So operating costs might be a fixed. If I had fixed and variable costs, I would love to have that information because then I would keep the fixed and the variable costs and it would allow me to then change the revenues and see the impact on the income. I think I might have a graph in one of my other presentations where I look at Shell's operating income as a function of the oil price. And it's less correlated than revenues because some of the costs don't move with oil prices.
Okay.
So now here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take the one variable that I'm most uncertain about, which is oil prices, and make it a distribution. Remember how Monte Carlo simulations work? I basically go pick an oil price out of the distribution, and the oil price in that distribution can be higher than 40 or lower than 40. And actually with oil prices, it's much easier to build this distribution because oil is traded. I can go look at the history of oil prices, and that distribution matches the history. So what I do is in the simulation, I go pick an oil price. Let's pick a number. The first time I draw, I get $52 a barrel. Higher than my existing 40, I estimate the revenues with $52 a barrel. I get the operating income based on the draw that I get from margins, I value Shell. And I do this again and again and again. Each time I value Shell, I get a different oil price, a different margin, a different value. What does it allow me to do? It allows me to come up with a distribution of Royal Dutch values. And again, remember how I used that distribution. Remember the stock price was 35? Well, the median value is 36. The median value is 37, which puts me pretty close to the price. It's fairly valued. But the upside here is huge because oil prices have a history of being volatile. So what you get in addition to an expected value is you get that distribution of values. And what it allows you to do when you value a commodity company is then allow the commodity price to vary and look at how the value of your company changes. One of the things that I didn't have to worry about with Shell is it doesn't have a lot of debt. But if you have a lot of debt for this company, guess what can happen if oil prices drop to $15 a barrel? What's the worry that many people have with especially small shale oil companies? Is the oil price keeps dropping, what could happen? it could drop below the debt, the company could go bankrupt. I can build that into the simulation as well and say, if the value drops below this number, shut the company down. So it actually allows you to estimate that probability of failure with a simulation rather than trying to make up a number to capture. Any questions on commodity companies or cyclical companies? So again, I'm using Monte Carlo simulations because I'm uncertain about oil prices. I would use that today because I don't think $22 is a sustainable price, but I don't know where it's going. Dave, go ahead.
For cyclical companies, I'm curious why you can't use pricing as a better measure of valuation, because if it's a truly cyclical company, you can look in the past and see exactly what other people think it's worth.
Why go pricing? If you believe that things revert back to normal, I mean, pricing gives you pricing. It can't give you a valuation. So let's not use those two words interchangeably. But if your point is margins adjust over time, cyclical companies come back from cycles, how would you build that into a DCF? What did you need to do? Today, you might be in a recession. You might have negative margins. But what's your target margin going to be?
The margin from the past.
Exactly.
Okay.
And the same thing with revenue. So you have revenue growth and margins at your disposal as assumptions. So if you believe that companies come out of cycles, you can use that to make your best judgments. And with these companies, you should have a lot of history, right?
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, so now I'm going to spend...
Go ahead. The mission said like they'll be coming out today and tomorrow.
Somebody's got the mic live. Patrick, what are you saying?
Oh, sorry. I actually unmuted myself.
Okay, good. Because I think there's a set. Okay, good. So now I'm going to set up the last step in this process. We're, 17 sessions into this class, right? And we've talked about value, 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 and more value. We're now going to switch gears and talk about price. So let me go back and show you that page. I showed you the start of this class. So all we've done so far is talked about value. We know what drives value. It's cash flows, growth, and risk. And we know the tools for valuation, discounted cash flow valuation, intrinsic valuation, even book value you can think of as value-based approaches. So everything we've done so far has been over here. But now let's talk about pricing. You know what sets price? Demand and supply. What drives demand and supply? Market mood, momentum, stories. And the tools for pricing are very different from the tools for valuation. It's multiples and comparables. You're looking to see what other people are paying for similar companies. You're trying to detect shifts in mood and momentum. You look at charts and technical analysis. In other words, pricing is a very different process than value. And the pricing process delivers a price. The value process delivers a value. And one of the central questions in valuation is, should the two numbers be the same? So let's start by looking at the pricing process. Now, about 4 or 3 years ago, when I was still living in New Jersey and we were looking at houses in California to buy, and for whatever reason, we made the mistake of picking the most expensive part of the most expensive state to look for houses. So this is La Jolla. This is a hut in La Jolla, because there are only six numbers in the price. But let me ask you a question. This is from Redfin. I pulled up the price. You know, you've got the price of the house, and you could probably do this with any house in any part of the country. How did this nice lady, Lisa Padilla, come up with that number for the house? May I ask you a question? Did she do a discounted cash flow valuation of the house? How do realtors come up with prices for houses? What do they do?
They look at nearby property.
They look at the neighborhood. They look at five houses that I might have sold in the recent past. They look at what people paid for those houses. And then they adjust for the fact that you have a bigger backyard or a bigger house. That's all they do, right? They do pricing. Okay? Now, you're saying those unsophisticated realtors. Have you ever picked up an equity research report? Pick it up if you get a chance and look at the equity research report. This is a typical equity research report where the person was asking me to buy this company called BB Biotech. I have no idea what the company does. But you know what the basis for their recommendation was? The price earnings ratio at which this company was trading was lower than the price earnings ratio of these 15 other companies that this guy claimed were just like BB Biotech. Who do you think is on more solid ground? the realtor pricing your house based on 5 houses in your neighborhood, or this equity research analyst who claims to have found 15 companies just like yours and come up with the pricing for your stock. I'm going to argue that the realtor is probably on more solid ground than the equity research analyst. The essence of pricing, though, is you make that judgment call on what you would pay for a stock based on what other people are paying for similar stocks. And I put quotes around similar. So the essence of pricing is very different from the essence of value. So let's step back. These 4 questions by now should be familiar, right? When I ask you what's the value of a company, I said there are 4 questions you need to answer. What are your cash flows from existing assets? What's the value added or destroyed by growth? How risky are your cash flows? And when will your firm become a mature firm? So when you sit down to value a company, you need to learn the business, you need to understand the business model so you can answer these questions. That's what each of you has tried to do in your discounted cash flow evaluation. Those answering those questions might require a story. Those stories become inputs. The inputs become a DCF. You value the company. You know what drives price? These are the variables that drive price. One is mood. You don't think mood matters? Just take a look at the market on a daily basis. You can tell when the mood is good and the mood is bad, when the mood is horrific. It basically shows up in movements and prices. Nothing to do with fundamentals. It's prices moving because the mood has shifted. That mood can be good. It can be bad. It can be fear. It can be greed. The second factor that drives pricing is what I call incremental information. I'll give you a very old example. I remember about 4 or 5 years ago, and I'm sitting down, and I was at my office watching Apple's stock price. Don't ask me why. And it drops like 8%. It lost about, over a course of minutes, it lost about $20 billion in value. So I said, what the hell happened? Why did it lose $20 billion? Something happened over there. So I started digging to see what happened. And it turned out that the drop in Apple's price had been driven by a tweet by some guy claiming to be in China. We have no idea where he was tweeting from, saying he was standing outside the Apple store in Shanghai. This was right when a new iPhone had come out. And he said, I'm standing outside the Apple store. We have no idea whether he's actually doing that. And he said, there's no line outside the store for the iPhone. That's it. That one tweet cost a $20 billion drop in market cap. You see, that makes no sense. Why would the value change by $20 billion just because a guy tweeted? The value doesn't, but the price can. Even in the last 6 weeks, if you look at the market, what drives the market up and what drives the market down, you look at the news story that supposedly does it, it's completely disproportionate. You're saying that caused the market to move by 10%? That makes no sense. But in pricing, incremental information drives price. Third, there's a lot of group behavior in pricing. You know what I mean? Group behavior. One person starts buying, everybody else starts buying. One person starts selling, everybody else starts selling. Your biggest source of information in pricing is looking at what other people are doing. Remember what Lord Keynes once said about the market? He said, the market's like a beauty contest where your job is not judging who the best looking person on the stage is. It's judging who the other judges think the best looking person in the stage is. In other words, your job becomes watching other people and what they're buying and selling, because that's what drives pricing. And finally, when you think about liquidity and trading issues, it's a pricing issue. That's why when you have a tough time selling something, you get afraid. When you get afraid, you knock down the price. It's one reason why when there's been talk of should we shut stock markets down during the coronavirus, during this crisis, my reaction is, please don't do it, because that will just make people even more anxious, even more afraid. It's not going to make it easier. It's going to make it more difficult for markets to come back. But these are the determinants of price. So let me summarize. Value is driven by cash flows, growth, and risk. You use a discounted cash flow value to estimate it. Pricing is driven by mood. It's driven by incremental information and rumors. It's driven by groupthink, and it's driven by liquidity factors. So you've got a value process and a price process. The value process delivers a value. The price process delivers a price. Now let's think about whether the two numbers should be the same. For a long time in finance, this is no longer true, but for a long time, the prevailing wisdom was markets are efficient. You see, what does that even mean? In an efficient market, you know what happens? The pricing process delivers a price roughly equal to value. It doesn't have to be equal all the time, but it's going to be roughly equal to value. There is no gap. So if you're a believer in efficient markets, you are entitled to use the word price and value interchangeably. You're talking about the same thing. But if you truly believe that there is no gap, you know what you should be doing? You shouldn't be valuing individual companies because there's really no difference. You might as well take the market price as a given. You should just buy index funds. So the most passive investment strategy, and it's based on this premise that price and value give you the same number, essentially leads you to index funds. You would never value a company. But I'm going to look at the two other extremes. The first is what I'm going to call the value extremes. You know where these guys hang out? They hang out usually in Omaha, Nebraska, in the middle of the year when Berkshire Hathaway has its annual meeting. They're convinced that they're the true investors. They're convinced that people who trade are just, you know, they come in out, they're shallow people, they can't think about anything beyond the next minute. But they believe that ultimately the truth has to win. Value is the only thing that matters and price will converge in value. So their view is, let me go buy stocks that I think are undervalued and hold until the price adjusts to value. As I go through these extremes, I want you to think about which extreme you're closer to or whether you're closer to the middle, the efficient. So the efficient market says there's no gap, buys index funds. The value extremist values individual companies and then buys companies where the price is much less than the value in hopes that the price will converge to value. And then there's the pricing extremists. These are the pure traders. They believe that the value people are eggheads. They're convinced that there's no such thing as intrinsic value, that you make money by buying low and selling high, that the key to this game is detecting which securities are mispriced, not misvalued. You know what I mean, mispriced? It's priced relative to other things. So you have a house that's priced at 300,000 in a neighborhood where every other house is a million, that's a mispriced house. A mispriced stock trades at 6 times earnings. Every other company in the sector trades at 50 times earnings. So it's mispriced. So the pricing extremist says, I don't care about value. I'm just going to buy based on mispricing. And the key to being successful in pricing is to get ahead of the game. In other words, you can ride momentum, but you got to get off that horse just before the momentum shifts, because you can lose everything you made when the reversal happens. So value extremists value companies and try to take advantage of the value. Pricers just try to figure out which way the price is moving. Pricers, I call traders. And people who believe in value, I call investors. There's no connotation to either. I'm not saying one is good and the other is bad. They're just two different ways of thinking about investing. We pause there because the two different mindsets, I want you to think about the difference between the two mindsets and where you might fall psychologically. Because as I said, there's no right or wrong. This is what's right for you. Now, I'll tell you what I think. I believe in value. I have faith. I'm not an extremist because I don't believe price has to converge on value. So I could be right and I could go bankrupt being right, but I believe in value, but you don't have to, right? So you have to do the DCF because that's part of this class, but you might at the end of this class, after you've priced your stock, say, look, I don't buy that DCF stuff. I'm a trader. I'm going to price this stock. So any questions about the difference between value and pricing and what might determine where you fall in that spectrum? Go ahead, Dave.
What if you believe in price in the short term and value in the long term? Is that a possible combination?
Can you be a Buddhist for the first half of the day and a Muslim for the second half? It's going to be really difficult to pull off, right?
Yeah.
Psychologically, it's very difficult to be both. So I'd love to say you can have your cake and eat it too, but you know, I tell people, you know what, play the game you came to play. You either believe in something or you don't. I've seen people try to do both, and usually they end up doing both badly. So I'll tell you how I incorporate pricing. I price everything I value. In addition to value, I price. You know what I mean by price? I look at PE ratios. You know why I look for pricing? Because it might tell me when to buy. Because if I find something undervalued and I can get momentum working in my favor as well, I get a double whammy. So I try to incorporate pricing into my timing decisions, but I play the value game because that's a game. I'm not good at the pricing game, and I have to be honest with myself on that and not try to price things because then I get into trouble. Any other questions? So now let's take each of these games and talk about their weakest links, because in a sense, you know, so I pick whichever game you think you're going to be playing in the future. And this is an ongoing process. This class hopefully will help you make that judgment. So let's say you decide that to become a trader. You're playing the pricing game. Here are the three things you have to worry about. First is, when you're pricing something, there is no anchor. You know what I mean by anchor? Let's take Bitcoin. Remember it was going up to 18, 20, 22,000? There's no upper limit. In pricing, the price could have gone to 100,000. There's no lower limit either. The price can go to zero. The problem with pricing is because there's no anchor, you're going to be reactive. There's no way you can be proactive in pricing because you're reacting to what the market's doing. And remember, with pricing, you're trying to gauge the crowd. It's not about how smart you are, but how good you are at gauging what the crowd's going to do. Now, one of my favorite books is called The Madness of Crowds. It's actually a great book. It's a very old book. It's about how bubbles form in markets. And we live in a world where people talk about the wisdom of crowds. We've turned everything over to crowds, right? Because how do you pick a restaurant now? You don't read restaurant reviews. What do you look at? You look at Yelp reviews. How do you decide what movies to watch? You don't read what the New York Times movie critic thinks. You look at Rotten Tomatoes, or you look at what people watch. We think, and Silicon Valley's been selling this thing of the wisdom of crowds. And crowds are wise. They do some smart things, but they also do some stupid things. So crowds are very difficult to read, and that's what you're trying to do in trading. So at least be honest about what you have to do if you're a trader. If you're a valuer, here's what your dilemma is. You value a stock, right? You bring everything you know about the company. You take every tool you have, you come up with the value. And there's a price, there's a gap. But you're uncertain about your value. You shouldn't be, right? Why? Because you might have been wrong about the revenue growth, the story you're telling. So first thing you worry about is you're uncertain about how much of a gap there is really between the value and the price. You come up with a number, but you're not sure whether you're wrong and in which direction. And here's the second thing you're uncertain about. Even if you're right about the value and the price, for you to make money, the price has to adjust to value. And you're uncertain about whether the gap will close. Remember, there's no guarantee it will, and when. So if you're an investor, your big worry is, could I be wrong about value? And even if I'm right about value, what if the price never adjusts to value? So let's talk a little bit about the strategies you can adopt as an investor to try to manage this uncertainty. The first is what I call the karmic approach. You know what you do in the karmic approach? You value a company, you look at the price, you say the stock is undervalued, I'm going to buy the stock, and then karma will take over. Fate will, and you just walk away. There are people who are able to do that. And if you're able to do that, just say, okay, I did the right thing. I might never make money, but I'm okay with that. And you know what? In a very rough sense, I'm okay with not making money on my investments, even if they're backed with value. The second is you try to look for a catalyst. You know what I mean by catalyst? Let's say you value a stock at 40, and the price is 25. For the price to go to the value, something's got to trigger that change, right? So let's think about some of the things that can trigger a change. One is a Carl Icahn targets your company. You see why that might trigger a change? People say, oh, Carl Icahn's looking at the stock. Let me look at the stock too. It could be a new CEO coming in. I'll tell you a very morbid signal I use when I try to decide whether to buy an undervalued company, especially if it's an older company. I look at the age of the CEO. I told you it was a morbid signal. You say, why are you looking at the age of the CEO? Because people pass on, and when they pass on, new management comes in. So if you have a company that's very old, it's set in its ways, the price is stuck at whatever it's been stuck at for a long time, you want a catalyst. And one of the advantages you have as an activist investor is you can operate as your own catalyst. So as you go through S&P Capital IQ and you try to screen for stocks, one of the screens you might try to throw in is the age of the CEO. Maybe that'll give you stocks where the catalyst is more likely to happen. So let me close today's session with an example of how this has played out. On my blog, I have valued Apple every year since September of 2011. In fact, the very last line in that thing should be September of 2019. So each year I value the stock, I compare to the price. So let's start in September of 2011. The price was 55, my value was 69. I thought the stock was undervalued and I owned Apple. In September of 2012, the price went to 95. The values also went up, but it went up to only 91. I sold the stock in September of 2012. September of 2013, the price had dropped back to 68. My value stayed pretty solid at 86. I bought the stock again. Do you see where I'm going? All those negatives are periods when the stock was undervalued. All the positives. I've bought Apple 5 times in the last 10 years. I've sold Apple 5 times in the last 10 years. I currently own Apple, and I've lost some money, obviously, in the last 6 weeks. But you can see why this is not a one-time game. So when you value a company and you conclude that it's overvalued or undervalued, that's a decision you're making today. Come back and revisit it in 6 months. For many of your companies, if you were quick off the market, you actually did your DCF prior to February 14th of 2020, you might have found your stock to be overvalued on February 12th. Let's say that's the day you did it. You value that same company today with all the changes that the last 6 weeks have brought. It is entirely possible that that stock is undervalued today, which means that you've gone from wanting to sell the stock 7 weeks ago to wanting to buy the stock. It's why we keep valuing companies. I never say never. I never look at a stock and say, I will never buy that stock. How can you even say that? At the right price, I will buy Carnival Cruise Lines. Maybe not Carnival Cruise Lines, but no. At the right price, I'd pretty much buy any company. The reason I wouldn't buy Carnival Cruise Lines, the right price might be zero, because if nobody ever gets on a cruise, what the heck would they do? But at the right price, I will buy pretty much any company. And at the wrong price, I don't care. It's the greatest company on the face of the earth. Valuation is a dynamic process. My values have changed over time, but so has the price. So don't beat yourself up when your value changes, because remember, the market is also changing its mind. You're trying to decide, should I buy or sell at a particular moment in time? Any questions on this Apple graph? I'm going to leave you with a picture. You know, those of you who don't recognize this picture, it's one of my favorite movies, The Wizard of Oz. You remember the story of The Wizard of Oz? This girl, Dorothy, lives in Kansas. She gets sucked up by a tornado, hurricane, whatever. Gets dropped into Oz and lands on top of a witch and kills the witch and facing homicide charges. The rest of the movie is about Dorothy wanting to get back to Kansas. So the way the movie starts is Dorothy lands on the witch, kills the witch, discovers she's in Oz and wants to go back to Kansas. She asks this munchkin by the side of the road, how do you get back? How do I get back to Kansas? And munchkin says, I don't know. Well, ask the Wizard of Oz. He knows the answer to everything. So Dorothy dances down this yellow brick road. The whole movie, she's dancing. She never walks. She dances. She jumps. She runs. And along the way, she collects this motley crew. A lion that wants courage, a tin man that wants basically each needs something. And they're all told, go see the Wizard of Oz. He has the answer to everything. So 3 hours later, it's a really long movie. They all end up at the wizard's chamber. And they all list out what they want. So Dorothy says, I want to go to Kansas. And the lion says, I want courage. And the wizard says, you got to come back tomorrow. It's like a government office. And they said, we've come all this way to ask you these things. And at that time, the curtain, that the wizard actually is sitting behind a curtain. The curtain falls and they discover there's no wizard. They say, where's this story going? It turns out that during the course of their journey, each of them got what they wanted. See these red shoes that Dorothy's wearing? Turns out the click she these shoes, she gets back to Kansas. On the journey, the lion fought off these bad guys and in the process got courage. You see where this is going? In valuation, we think that there is somebody out there, a Wizard of Oz, who has the answer to everything. That Wizard of Oz for you might be Google search. There isn't. Most of the answers to the questions you face in valuation, you get the answers during the journey, in the process of doing valuation. So I know you've valued one company already. That's the company, hopefully, for the project. But don't stop there. The more you value companies, the more you will learn how to answer these questions on your own. So on that optimistic or pessimistic count, I'm going to end this session. Are there any final questions before I sign off? Chen, go ahead.
So Professor, I have a question about your Apple valuation. So every time you arrived at different valuations compared to the market price, like what were they driven by? Was it?
Well, part of it is my basic story for Apple remained the same, that it's a smartphone company, which is a cash machine. However, each earnings report brings out new information. So new iPhone perhaps increases the market, or one of the things that increased my value between 2018 and 19 was the Apple services business finally starting to deliver revenues. So it's a basic story, but the outlines of the story change as new information comes in. So mostly new earnings report, the price of risk is changing in the market. So some of it comes from the company, some of it from the economy doing well during that period, and some of it from the market price of risk itself changing.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Tim, go ahead. Tim, you have a question?
Yes. Hi, can you hear me?
Yep.
Perfect. So you started the section with the difference between pricing and valuing with the example of like real estate houses.
Yeah.
And I for my parents, I actually tried to do a DCF for our apartment once.
Is it a rental property? Wait. Is it a rental property?
So it's a rental property, exactly. And so
a rental property can both value and price. But I'll be quite honest with you. Let's say you do a valuation of your rental property based on, I'll give you an example of a neighborhood I'm familiar with. Let's take San Diego. Mm-hmm. You take any rental property in San Diego and you take the present value of the rental income you get from that property. It's going to be much, much lower than the pricing here because we've been in a boom, at least leading into 6 weeks ago in housing prices here.
Okay.
So the problem with investing in real estate as a cash, as a business, which is what a lot of people used to do, in many parts of this country now, you're being driven out of the market. Because you look at the price in the Bay Area and you say, there's no way I can make enough rental income to cover it. You see, why are the people buying? You know why they're buying at a high price? What are they hoping to do? Sell it to somebody else at an even higher price. That's the pricing game. So Tim, you're right. You can value rental properties. Residential houses, much more difficult. But rental properties can value based on the present value of rental income. But it might be much lower than the price. I don't know, what part of the country are your parents in?
Well, so this was actually in France, so completely okay. Different country.
So it might be that France, the pricing is more consistent with the rental income.
But well, so here's actually the problem that I was facing was I had to get that rental numbers from somewhere. And so what I did is I looked at comparable apartments in the region and I looked at what they get for rent. And so I realized that to get my valuation, I was pricing it again. So,
well, you're not, right? You're trying to project cash flows if you rent it. So it's right. Not really pricing. You're getting because if your property had already been rented, you wouldn't have had to do this, right? Because then you'd have had a rental income from last year. And then you said it's because a property had been held off that you had to do this. So it's like using margins for comparable companies to get cash flow. But you're still doing a discounted cash flow valuation. You're just getting a piece of information by looking at what the rental amounts are. So that's not pricing. It's still valuation. You're getting information from peer group, which we do in DCF as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you're still doing a DCF.
Okay. Thank you.
Laura, hit me on YouTube. Yeah, go ahead.
So for my valuation, I'm doing Lyft, and mm-hmm. I've been reading through their 10K and looking at S&P and whatnot, and I can't find an interest expense number, but the word that keeps coming up is interest income.
That's because do they have debt?
No.
Then you won't have interest expenses, right? So just put zero.
Oh, so I shouldn't use the interest income number?
No, don't do that.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. And I want to respond to why you don't want to use the interest income number. The interest income is coming from the cash balance they have as a company. And because you're going to be adding the value of the cash, you also count the income as part of your cash flows, you'd be double counting.
Okay. That's what I was wondering. All right. Thank you.
That's interest expense. Jen, go ahead. Jen?
Hi, Professor.
How are you?
Yeah. Good. So I was doing the company that has a large proportion of the leases and the rental. I just want to make sure that the rental expense should not be included as the CapEx if it is really.
Do they have a rental commitment as well? It's the commitments that are the issue, not the expense itself. So if it's only the lease, but they have commitments, just count the leases.
Yes. So the rentals are, because like they are monthly payments, so it's not like a long-term commitment. So
then don't include them.
Okay. And the problem was that I said that like the industry average operating margins, and then I got a very weird reinvestment rate of about like over 100% for like 4 years.
Why is that weird? Do companies sometimes reinvest more than their operating income?
But like if I look at the history.
Then use the average. Any 1 year you can get strange looking reinvestment rates. In fact, many people in the class are probably getting negative reinvestment rates for their companies last year. Why? Because they didn't do any CapEx. So that's why we average out across time. So look across time and look across 5 years, maybe even 10, to get an average reinvestment rate.
Yeah. So the historical, like over 5 years, is about like 60%.
Okay.
But
is that consistent with your story? Do you see them as a growing company?
I see it like not at a fast growth stage, but
60%. What's the return on capital?
It's around like 15%.
So are you comfortable giving them a 9% growth rate for the next 5 years?
Not
yet. If you want to give them a lower growth rate?
Yeah.
Then do the growth rate first and estimate what reinvestment rate is consistent with that growth rate.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Dave? Go ahead, Dave.
My question is, with regards to the lawsuit value, I have to add that in my spreadsheet separately, right?
Yeah, you have to do it separately. I haven't built it in.
Oh, okay. Do you have any type of like template to build that out, or?
And it's a probability that you will lose. It's like it's like estimating regime change in Saudi Arabia. It's very unique to the company, and what the loss is. It a single lawsuit or is it a class action? Is it
37 max lawsuits?
Then read up what their expected liability will be. Maybe in the footnotes they might mention potential liabilities, but look up news stories. There's no one template. It's just a probability that you will lose the lawsuit and what it will cost you.
Okay, that's all I have for now. Thank you,
Connor. Last question, then we're going to sign off.
Yeah, so I'm doing Hermes, and they haven't really published their 2019 statements, but they have a presentation, and therefore the numbers are in like Capital IQ. But for their revenue section, like because there's no statement, there's like a big other revenue aspect, and they don't ever go into what other revenue, like where the revenue is coming from.
Yeah, for the like moment, 100%. just leave it. No, put in the updated numbers. But you know what? The 10K or the annual report will get filed before May 11th, so you can go in and fill in the details. So for the moment, what can you do?
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Ayan, last question. Go ahead.
Professor, what if there's a merger in the, like, there's a potential merger in the, for like, in 2 years
ignore
or something?
Ignore it. What's the effect of a merger on your value?
I don't know.
It's a big project. What will it do to your value? Increase it or do nothing?
Yeah, so I don't know. Should I, like, take into account or, like...
What will it do? In fact, it's very simple. A merger can affect your value only if the value that you get is... better the price you pay, right? So if you have a fair value merger, what's going to happen to your value per share?
In other words,
you pay exactly what a company is worth. Your value per share should be unaffected. So, no, basically, it shouldn't change at all. So that's why you can't bring mergers in, because even if you know the company being targeted, until you know the price you pay, you can't even evaluate whether it's good for you, bad for you, or neutral for you, because it's a difference between the price and the value that will affect your value per share, including synergies. So when I talk about value, I'm including the synergies in that value.
Okay, so I ignore it for now?
Just ignore it for now. And if they get specific and they say, we're paying $800 million for this company, if you really, really want to do it, and I won't hold it against you if you don't, here's what you need to do. You need to value the target company with the synergies built in, and then take that difference and add it onto your value.
Okay. Thank you, Professor.
Okay, folks, that's about it. Thank you very much, and I will see you next Monday. Take care. Bye-bye. Have a good week.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.